or did not necessarily embrace the idea of the creation of a centralized nation-state under no rule. This was particularly true in the south of Vietnam, where the DRV's control had always been weakest, and the French had long promoted a policy of divide and rule which favored local fiefdoms. Equally important, ethno-cultural diversity had always been greatest in the Mekong Delta, where Viet colonialism was not much older than its French successor. In fact, King Sihanouk had lobbied the French intensively to cede Cochin China to Cambodia in 1949, claiming that most of it, called Kampuchea Krom and Khmer, and its 400,000 ethnic Khmers were historically Cambodian. The French refused to accord the Kampuchean Krom Khmers a separate legal identity, even though they had granted such a status to hundreds of thousands of ethnic minority peoples populating the highlands. Religious groups also contested Diem state building. Economic change and shifting power relations since the 1920s had thoroughly politicized and militarized the Hoa Hao and Cao Dai faith supporters. Combined, their leaders commanded over 2 million followers by 1954, and, thanks to the Japanese and the French, operated their own territories, economies, and militias. Although Diem tried to staff his state with fellow Catholics, even the loyalties of the 1.5 million Catholics now in the South were not monolithic. Many of them exceeded Ngo Dinh Diem's own wishes in their desire to avenge their enforced exile from their northern homes in 1954 and to build an uncompromising anti-communist nationalism. Little wonder that so many French, American, and Vietnamese, including the communists, doubted Diem's ability to last. Ngo Dinh Diem's first taste of the unruliness of the South occurred in early 1955, when he attempted to rein in the sects, the pejorative term used to refer collectively and inaccurately to the Bin Shuyen, Hoa Hao, and Cao Dai. Patriotic though their leaders were, they were no more willing to cede their autonomy to Diem state building than they had been to that of Ho Chi Minh a decade earlier. For Ngo Dinh Diem, a professional civil servant by training, this was entirely unacceptable. As he complained to one American confidant, "I am not content to wait for the chaos around me to turn into order of its own accord. I am going to try to bring order out of chaos myself." Indeed, one of the things the Ngos admired most in the communists was their ability to do just that, establish order and loyalty, and then structure it methodically and forcefully. While powerful Americans, including the newly arrived CIA station chief, General Edward Lansdale, certainly sympathized, he and others advised caution, stressing the need for conciliation in dealing with the sects. Meanwhile, the American ambassador sent cable after cable to Washington, warning that Diem was not up to the task. Events came to a head in early 1955, when the French subsidies to the sects dried up and the Ngo brothers moved to take control of them. To do this, they used the army, their contacts, diplomacy, and even American money if it allowed them to reappropriate loyalties. Those who rallied to the national cause received pretty medals and cushy positions, just as the Democratic Republic of Vietnam and the French had done before them, while the Ngos simultaneously played off one stubborn leader against another. They adroitly exploited the leader of the Cao Dai, General Trinh Minh Thay's dissatisfaction with the French. He defected from them 4 times before 1954, to rally his forces to the Ngo national cause. The Ngos cut similar deals with the Hoa Hao and the Catholics. The Bin Shuyen's Bai Vien, however, refused to relinquish his lucrative business interests. In exchange for he and his followers' defection from the Democratic Republic of Vietnam in 1948, the French had allowed him to carve out a very profitable niche in the Saigon gambling world and in the trafficking of illicit narcotics. By 1954, Bai Vien's riches were enormous, and his influence was such that his men had penetrated the upper reaches of the Associated State of Vietnam's police force. Ngo Dinh Diem now called in the army to put a stop to all of this. In late April, fighting broke out in and around Saigon. Despite intense firefights, the Bin Shuyin forces were dispersed within a couple of weeks. Diem closed down Bai Vien's operations and looked on with quiet satisfaction as the Bin Shuyin's legendary Grand Casino burned to the ground. The Prime Minister then went after the remaining splinter groups. In 1956, his men executed the Hoa Hao's rebel leader, Ba Kut, putting an end to the War of the Sects. Civil war in post-colonial Vietnam was more than just a communist versus anti-communist affair. While France's General Paul Ely called for the Prime Minister's removal as he watched his southern allies disappear one by one, the High Commissioner was no longer in a position to do much without American support. Indeed, high-ranking Americans had come away from the wars against the sects impressed by Ngo Dinh Diem's ability to score victories in such difficult circumstances, convinced that this was the man with whom they could work in building a strong anti-communist state. Dulles now overruled his ambassador in Saigon, instructing diplomats to throw their weight behind Diem. This support was not unconditional, and it was often as paternalistic as that of the French had been. Many continued to question Ngo Dinh Diem's capacity to rule. But for American officials keen on containing communism, there was room for optimism. They had few other choices in any case. Joint state building now got underway in full force. American aid helped Diem to train a new generation of technicians, doctors, policemen, and bureaucrats. Young officers traveled to Fort Leavenworth instead of Saint-Cyr to study modern military science, as American money also poured in for agricultural development and infrastructure projects. By 1956, the Americans provided Ngo Dinh Diem's Vietnam with $270 million annually, placing it among the top recipients of aid per capita in the world. Vietnam, the Eisenhower administration declared, had become an example for people everywhere who hate tyranny and love freedom. Life magazine dubbed Diem the tough miracle man of Vietnam. Most importantly, the Americans could continue their containment of communism in Asia with this man, without sending troops, and without the French casting a colonial hue over Washington's efforts. Flushed with victory, the Ngo brothers then moved against the only person who could block them, their former emperor, Bao Dai, who had served as their head of state since 1949. Although Bao Dai had abdicated as emperor in August 1945, he had remained as head of state of the Associated State of Vietnam and, since 1955, of the State of Vietnam. There was something tragic about the Ngo assault on the last emperor of Vietnam. The Ngo family had faithfully served the Nguyen dynasty since the 19th century. Diem owed his premiership to the one-time emperor, not to the Americans. And in many ways, Bao Dai had never wanted to lead, and the French had already wrecked the monarchy in any case. But his long association with the French and his passivity cast a dangerous shadow of collaboration and weakness over the Vietnam that the Ngos wanted to make. And this is why, over the summer of 1955, the brothers launched a massive propaganda drive to destroy what little remained of the ex-emperor's prestige. They then carefully stage-managed a national referendum so that the people could decide the fate of the erstwhile monarch. In fact, the Ngos decided everything. In a sham vote held on the 23rd of October, 1955, marred by arrests and electoral manipulations, Ngo Dinh Diem received 98% of the 5.8 million votes cast. This fraudulent referendum served more than anything else to cover up what was in reality a palace coup and provide Diem with the clean break and popular mandate he wanted to create a new Vietnam divorced from its collaborative past. 3 days later, Diem presided over the creation of the Republic of Vietnam under his presidency. He simultaneously declared that there would be no elections to unify South Vietnam and North Vietnam. The Americans backed him on both counts and recognized his government immediately. The French acquiesced, unwilling to reconvene the negotiations at Geneva or to hold the Americans to organizing the elections. Vietnamese communists now had the choice of either accepting that the 17th parallel would become a de jure border separating two sovereign states, or of renewing their fight to create one sovereign Democratic Republic of Vietnam, theirs. Resetting Communist Vietnam and the Republic of Ho Chi Minh. Extending DRV sovereignty above the 17th parallel. In October 1954, Ho's government returned to Hanoi and began administering the previously Franco-ASV territories, towns, and public buildings. At the outset, the People's Army of Vietnam was in charge. It tracked down and crushed armed minority groups that had worked with the French in the highlands. The security services went after real and imagined enemy spies and sleeper cells, worried in particular by those in the Greater Vietnam Coalition who had dominated the Associated States of Vietnam bureaucracy. Despite their support of Ho Chi Minh in the early years, Catholics and minority peoples were as suspect as the sects were for Diem in the South. Meanwhile, the People's Army of Vietnam troops received orders to slow down the massive exodus of people to the South via military force if necessary, as its officers carefully extended the Democratic Republic of Vietnam's highly militarized resistance administration into their new territories in the north. These particular areas, mainly in the River Delta valleys and the big cities, were new because they had not formally been part of the DRV. They had been administered originally by the French, and thereafter by the French in partnership with the Associated State of Vietnam. General Vuong Thua Vu, the man who had led the Battle of Hanoi in late 1946, ruled the capital until civilian authorities took over about a year later. Although the Vietnamese Workers' Party, VWP, had often been able to recruit communist cadres who had operated covertly in the occupied zone of the Associated State of Vietnam during the conflict itself, after the war, the new leadership found it had little choice but to maintain many of the former regime's civil servants as the Democratic Republic of Vietnam opened police stations, schools, tax offices, census bureaus, and hospitals. The government nevertheless carefully collected information on people in the new zone, checked their family backgrounds, listed their occupations, ethnicities, and religions. Officials introduced the DRV's laws, flags, currency, and stamps. Street names in Hanoi changed yet again as old monuments and statues gave way to new ones. Ho Chi Minh's portrait went up on office walls and stamps everywhere, as did Diem's in the south. The Democratic Republic of Vietnam extended its national project through new school manuals, history books, officer and teacher training schools, and a host of cultural activities. From late 1954, the party also went to work communizing all of North Vietnam, carefully extending the rectification, emulation, propaganda, and mobilization campaigns to the areas which the French and the ASV had previously administered. Next to Uncle Ho's portrait hung pictures of Marx, Lenin, Stalin, or Mao. Of course, the Democratic Republic of Vietnam never abandoned nationalism and anti-colonialism as its official ideologies, but as in the Soviet Union, China, North Korea, and Cuba, the Vietnamese leadership introduced communism as the new state religion and deployed class as the new category for defining social and political identity. Peasants, workers, and those coming from loyal families obtained the best jobs and enjoyed better access to higher education. Since 1950, Vietnamese communists had already imported Marxism-Leninism and a heavy dose of Maoism to structure the party state in the Maquis, indoctrinate a faithful bureaucracy and a fresh military caste, and transform the society and its economy in the communist mold. They now extended this to all of Vietnam above the 17th parallel. Nowhere was this desire to remake Vietnam better seen than in the land reform campaign that lasted from 1953 to 1956. Communist land reform was designed to achieve several essential and interconnected goals. One, to mobilize the majority peasant population for making war up until 1954. Two, to increase the party's state legitimacy and social base. Three, to extend and anchor its bureaucratic control over people and territory. Four, to destroy the heretofore dominant feudal and bourgeois classes and power structures blocking the communist transformation of state, society, and culture. And, in doing all this, five, to prepare the road ahead for eventual full-scale collectivization of agriculture and the concomitant industrialization of the economy along Sino-Soviet lines. The communists had already started initiating full-blown land reform in the zones it controlled from 1953. Starting in late 1954, cadres dispersed across former Franco-ASV territories to do the same. They had to take control of village society by promoting this top-down social revolution that would allow them to empower the peasants, install a new bureaucratic elite, and take control of the countryside. They carried with them lists of classes to identify and corresponding quotas to fill for land redistribution. The new social categories were landlords, Địa Chủ, rich peasants, Phu Nông, middle peasants, Trung Nông, poor peasants, Ban Nông, and agricultural laborers, Co Nông. The main idea was to redistribute land and power from the first two categories to the other three. To supervise this socio-economic upending, the Vietnamese Workers' Party relied on its cadre-run special people's courts, endowed with extraordinary legal powers authorizing arbitrary arrest, capital punishment, the determination of class, the dismissal of local authorities, and the confiscation of individual property and assets. Over the next 2 years, these mobile courts visited the majority of villages in the new zones. Military cadres identified landholders, brought them before the courts, carefully gathered the villagers around the accused, and encouraged the crowd to denounce their cruel exploiter. These hate-filled struggle sessions often ended in violence. The party leadership authorized this radical transformation of the rural state and society. In late 1952, Ho Chi Minh had traveled to Beijing and Moscow to obtain increased military assistance and to inform Stalin of his determination and his party's plans to embark upon land reform. Upon his return, the land reform campaign began in earnest. That land reform destroyed the feudal landowning class and redistributed over 2 million acres of land, 800,000 hectares, there can be no doubt. But this social revolution also wreaked socio-economic havoc and indescribable psychological pain. The cadres it deployed were often incompetent and brutal. Few knew the villages they visited. Many were excessively zealous and all too eager to please their superiors instead of the poor subjects they had hauled before them. In order to produce enough class enemies in a delta that had never historically produced many feudalists, big landowners, or bourgeois merchants to begin with, they began to misclass middle class and richer peasants as such, who were often in reality dirt poor, cooking the books as they went, but forgetting that what they were doing had catastrophic consequences. The result was that these powerless people were suddenly stigmatized by the state and ostracized by their former neighbors and friends. The communists also attacked bourgeois and landowning individuals who had duly paid their taxes, donated land, reduced their rents, supported the War of Independence, and sent fathers, sons, and daughters to the front. Nguyen Thi Nam was a case in point. Born into a small business family near Hanoi in 1906, she went into business young in order to make ends meet. Her husband had squandered everything they had in the first years of the marriage. Her business savvy was such that she became a highly successful merchant in the emerging steel and cement industries in Haiphong. Before long, the Queen of Iron, as she was known, was investing in land in Tainan Province, where, by the 1940s, she owned the largest plantation there. She took pride in modernizing this plantation with equipment imported from Europe and established the country's first granulated sugar factory. She donated large amounts of money to Ho Chi Minh's government and, during the war against the French, urged her two sons to join the army. They did. A capitalist, though she most certainly was, Nguyen Thi Nam's support was such that she was widely referred to as a resistance mother, Mae Kang Chien, in the Democratic Republic of Vietnam. All of this changed as the Vietnamese communists presided over the Maoist transformation of the Democratic Republic of Vietnam upon Ho Chi Minh's return from Moscow and Beijing in 1952. As Vietnamese communists joined hands with their Chinese advisors to implement land reform, they singled out Nguyen Thi Nam. She was classified as a bourgeois traitor. She was, by then, from the wrong class in what was a very virulent class war. This remarkable businesswoman now embodied the enemy class, an obstacle to the party's ability to take the peasantry in hand, remake rural society ideologically and administratively, and prepare for the ultimate collectivization of the countryside. Patriotism was no longer sufficient to save her. In the summer of 1953, the party put Nguyen Thi Nam on trial under a red banner which read, "Overthrow the despotic landlord Nguyen Thi Nam, take back the land for the peasants." To make an example of her, cadres placed Nam before hundreds of poor peasants and led them in hate-filled denunciations of this atrocious landlord and her long list of crimes. Whipped into a frenzy of hate, the crowd jeered at her, spat on her, and slapped her. At some point in July 1953, as land reform officially got underway, the Vietnamese communists executed her. Her execution was not the only one. How many occurred? No one knows for sure, but the most reliable estimates put the number of killed between 5,000 and 15,000. Hundreds, possibly thousands, committed suicide, while others fled. Over 3 years, the Vietnamese Workers' Party dispatched tens of thousands of cadres to organize 5 successive waves of hate and fear that surged through villages, homes, and lives. The Communist Party encouraged children to spy on their parents, neighbors, to denounce each other, and required local village officials to follow orders or risk severe sanction. One man has recently recalled how the party marched into his village and turned his world upside down. One day, while I was out playing, my mother suddenly dragged my younger brother and me back to our house and sat us down next to the cooking fire. She said to us, sobbing, "From now on, you need to stay in the house and look after your little brother. You cannot go out to play or go to school anymore. If you meet your friends, you must bow and call them sir and madam." When I responded with pouting and sulking, my mother slapped my face so hard that I saw stars. After that, she hugged my brother and me and cried with all her heart, saying things I did not understand. "Tan, our family has been assigned a bad class status." Not until years later did I begin to understand the injustice and humiliation my mother had to endure. I also began to see that the slap she gave me reflected her resolve to overcome the demands of that horrible and pointless period. Despite the fact that our family never had enough food, my mother was labeled a cruel village tyrant. Moreover, the land reform team forbade us from having any relations with our relatives and neighbors in the village. That was the most painful and humiliating aspect of the experience for my mother. All we had to gnaw on was moldy, dried cassava roots. There were many meals when we ate only banana root porridge. Every night the sound of the village militia marching past the gate of our house put the fear of death into my mother. In November 1956, resistance to land reform was such that the Communist Party had to send in the People's Army of Vietnam's 325th Division to quell what was a full-blown peasant revolt in Koinh Lu. The situation was so bad that Ho Chi Minh and Vo Nguyen Giap publicly apologized for the errors their party had committed against the people during the last 3 years. Although Ho took over the leadership of the Communist Party from Truong Chinh, who was cast as the main author of the disastrous land reform, everyone, including Ho Chi Minh and Vo Nguyen Giap, were to be counted as responsible for wanting to apply the coercive Stalinist method of collectivization. The party promised to right the wrongs, to reclass those who had been wrongly categorized, to return land and assets, and dismantle the special courts. But as Ho admitted, the party could not bring the dead back to life. Instead, the party organized a massive rectification of errors campaign during which leaders and cadres publicly confessed their sins. This public and highly ritualized act of ideological contrition served to clean the slate, ensure that all had the new, right thinking, and to reassert the legitimacy of communist rule before moving on again. This mise-en-scene fooled none of those who had suffered so much in a revolution in which they had had so little to say. Even those who benefited from finally obtaining a plot of land would have to give it up in a few short years' time when the party sought to take it back. As in China and the Soviet Union, what the collectivization of the countryside required trumped any other considerations. Failed Communist Reformism, 1954-9. The excesses of land reform program led to unprecedented internal calls for reform. Highest on that list was judicial change. Just as Republican voices reacted with shock to the extrajudicial methods used by the French colonial authorities to suppress peasant revolts in 1908 and 1930-31, a number of supporters of the new state of the Democratic Republic of Vietnam couldn't believe that the Party of the Masses had committed the same sins as the colonizers. Where was the rule of law, many asked? Did the peasants, 80% of the population, have any legal rights? If the 1946 Constitution had enshrined them, then why had the communists just violated them so blatantly? These were not new questions. Ho himself had personally witnessed the French firing on starving peasants in 1908, the very event that had sent him on the road to republicanism, into the League of Human Rights, and on to revolution. Outraged peasants seeking justice from Vietnamese cadres who had just violated their basic human rights flooded the office of Vietnam's best-known lawyer, the French-trained Nguyen Minh Thuong. People were so outraged that the party responded by allowing newspapers to publish full reports on the land reform abuses which had occurred up to 1957, including information about the use of state-sponsored torture, executions, and the existence of concentration camps. Incensed, the devout party member and well-known journalist of the 1930s, Nguyen Hu Dang, called for the introduction of a legal code independent of the party state that would protect individual rights while still allowing for more effective communization of the countryside. Others petitioned for the reform of the judiciary, the drafting of a new constitution protecting individual liberties, and the awakening of the National Assembly. It had only met once since 1946, in late 1953, in order to approve the land reform unanimously. This communist reform-minded constitutionalism bumped up against the Vietnamese Politburo's simultaneous goal of drafting a new constitution which would codify the DRV's wartime transformation into a communist state and make the necessary preparations for collectivization. The Vietnamese Workers' Party's inner core was determined to create a new constitution placing the Democratic Republic of Vietnam officially under the leadership of a People's Democratic Dictatorship. Unlike the Constitution of 1946, which was designed to unite and attract all segments of society, This new constitution would legalize the preeminence of the Communist Party, put it in charge of a new social alliance between the workers and the peasants, and align the DRV's economy with the international communist model. The 1946 Constitution no longer fitted the needs or the reality of this new revolutionary state. As Ho Chi Minh told young children gathered around him in 1959, "When you grow up, you will have a communist constitution." Not everyone inside the Democratic Republic of Vietnam agreed with Ho or wanted a dictatorship of the proletariat. Although the details remain shrouded in mystery, in late 1956, a handful of unidentified deputies, apparently shaken by what had occurred in their constituencies during the land reform campaigns, joined reformist-minded lawyers, jurists, and intellectuals like Tuong and Dang in starting to push for constitutional reform, including the empowerment of the legislative and judiciary branches of the government as set out in the 1946 Constitution. In December 1956, when the National Assembly convened for the third time in its existence, members agreed to establish the personnel who would undertake a special commission on constitutional reform and who would duly submit a new project. The Vietnamese Workers' Party's Tran Huy Lu was in charge, seconded by Ho serving as honorary president. Within weeks, deputies in the National Assembly asserted their theoretical power. In January 1957, the Assembly passed three laws, one on the inviolability of the home and of correspondence, another ensuring freedom of assembly, and a third on the freedom of religion and the press. Although the 1946 Constitution had already guaranteed such rights, the question now was whether they would be enforced and to what extent. In light of the Vietnamese Workers' Party's errors, that is, its prior violation of its citizens' rights, would the legislature or its judicial branches be able to check the party's power in the post-1954 Democratic Republic of Vietnam? Not one of these three laws was actually promulgated in 1957, but it is clear that intense behind-the-doors debates had occurred on the nature of the new constitution, the limits of state and party power, and the protection of individual human rights. Like the French before them, the communist leadership feared the implications of allowing a democratically elected National Assembly to operate independently. It was the party which ran the state. Simultaneous and closely related calls for legal reform occurred in the arts. Between 1954 and 1956, a diverse range of artists, writers, poets, playwrights, and intellectuals loyal to the regime increasingly called for greater intellectual and artistic freedoms. This movement started in early 1955 when Tran Dan, a military writer and veteran of Dien Bien Phu, found himself undergoing re-education and rectification when he dared to ask General Nguyen Chi Tan, head of the PAVN's General Political Directorate, for greater freedom of expression in the stifling Maoist-minded world in which he worked. Tran Dan's case became a rallying cry for intellectuals and artists who published two journals with the express goal of reforming the party's excessive hold over culture and the arts, Nan Van, Humanism, and Yai Pham, Fine Arts. Contributors to these journals came from the army, from among French-trained intellectuals, and included such intellectual heavyweights as the renowned philosopher Tran Duc Tao. Most were communists, some were not, but they all had supported the regime. The party's stance oscillated from tolerance and even tacit sympathy for its opponents to open hostility toward them and outright repression. Such indecision was linked as much to the land reform program's errors as to the simultaneous secret speech Nikita Khrushchev had just delivered in early 1956. In it, the head of the Soviet Communist Party criticized Stalin's crimes against his own people and his cult of personality. Khrushchev also advocated a policy of peaceful coexistence and promoted a wide range of socioeconomic and legal reforms to regain the support of the people, above all the peasants, who had suffered terribly during Stalin's rule. This was one of Khrushchev's big foreign policy changes in 1956 that infuriated Mao and not a few Vietnamese. Peaceful coexistence was the new buzzword for trying to calm down the Cold War and work things out with the capitalists through negotiation. Unsurprisingly, this Soviet-approved de-Stalinization also found supporters in the Democratic Republic of Vietnam, as it did across the communist world. The problem was that the VWP's leadership would only go so far. Like their Chinese counterparts, they had only just taken power and were doing all they could to consolidate it, using many of the Stalinist methods Khrushchev now condemned. Ho was not about to abandon his cult of personality when he needed it to win back popular support after the land reform debacle. The great upheaval was the price to be paid for taking control of the state and society from top to bottom. Most importantly, the peasants' protest in Khoeng Lu in November 1956 coincided with the popular uprising against communist rule in Hungary, which started on the 23rd of October. With Ngô Đình Diệm building a southern state and even speaking of a march on the north, the Vietnamese Workers' Party welcomed the Soviet invasion of Hungary on the 4th of November and decided that it could not let its own reformers transform social discontent or even the regime into something no one could predict or control. Though it took them longer than the Soviets' quelling of the popular uprising in Hungary did, by 1959, Ho Chi Minh had stopped legislative attempts to curtail the party's power constitutionally. On the 1st of January 1960, he promulgated the Democratic Republic of Vietnam's new constitution, enshrining the power of the Communist Party, ensuring its supremacy over that of the National Assembly, and guaranteeing that communism was now the official ideology of the DRV, its economy, and society. And the communist leadership closed the journals Nhan Van, Humanism, and Yai Pham, Fine Arts, for good. As in China and the Soviet Union, there had to be ideological homogeneity among cadres, officers, and intellectuals. Toward the end of his life, Tran Duc Thao, one of Vietnam's greatest minds, a man who had collaborated with French philosopher Jean-Paul Sartre earlier in his career, found himself psychologically destroyed by constant party attacks on individual thought. Extending Republican Sovereignty in the South. Like Ho Chi Minh, Ngô Đình Diệm may have come from a Mandarin family, but he was anything but an inward-looking Confucian, Mandarin, or traditionalist. Diem saw himself as a revolutionary. He certainly possessed one of the most modern educations the French could offer, not least of all in administrative practices. He was obsessed with modern sovereignty, nationalism, and state-building. And although the Ngô brothers abhorred the class war the communists had unleashed in the countryside, they agreed that the creation of a new Vietnam did turn on the transformation of rural society, and as Diem had expressed his thinking on rural change in 1949, it is also a social revolution for the economic independence of the Vietnamese farmer and laborer. I advocate the most advanced and bold social reforms, while preserving human dignity and respect, in order that all people in the new Vietnam may earn a living as truly free people. In practice, the Ngô brothers had little more respect for the freedom of the people than the communists they so despised. The Ngôs were nepotistic, authoritarian, and heavy-handed in their rule. If Ho Chi Minh ensured the Communist Party held a monopoly on power by 1960, Ngô Đình Diệm had already concentrated state power within an authoritarian executive branch of his government. Indeed, the constitution upon which the new republic rested from late 1955 onward was the result of the new National Constitutional Assembly, which had been hastily convened under Diem's personal control. This constitution provided extraordinary powers to its government's executive branch by subordinating all legislature to presidential fiat. Everyone knew what Article 3 of the Constitution meant. The activities of the executive and the legislative agencies must be brought into harmony. The president is vested with the leadership of the nation. The president enjoyed vast emergency powers. He controlled foreign policy, could declare war, make treaties, commanded the military, and had the power to make all military and civil appointments. The Constitution guaranteed the people's freedom of expression, but, as in the North, if any individual was deemed to threaten national security, then he or she forfeited his or her rights. Communism was outlawed, just as anti-communism was in the North. Such labels could and would be used abusively by the state to neutralize all sorts of enemies. Despite paying it lip service, Diem bypassed the National Assembly, preferring to rule by decree, just like Ho Chi Minh had done during the entire Indochina War. The Republic of Vietnam's judiciary was not independent of the state and had few oversight powers, which led to many of the same human rights abuses committed by the communists: arbitrary arrest, censorship, torture, execution, forced labor, and the use of concentration camps. And behind the president stood his family, not any sort of wider political coalition. By smashing, then refusing to open the political doors to religious groups like the Cao Dai and the Hoa Hao, each one as opposed to communism as he was, Diem not only failed to develop a wider inclusive anti-communism nationalism that could have built up his legitimacy, but he also frustrated such groups and made enemies of them by keeping them out of the political system. The president's mistrust was such that he failed to create anti-communist alliances even with the Vietnamese Nationalist Party and the Greater Vietnam Coalition. Diem struggled even to keep on good terms with those followers of his who made up the base of his support, the Catholic refugees. As in the North, no state building wreaked the greatest havoc upon the very people it was designed to uplift and save. It was never intended that way, of course. Diem's land reform was top-down, authoritarian, and badly administered. He spoke in the name of the poor masses, but never asked them what they wanted or provided them with the institutional means to make their needs known. If the VWP rammed land reform through its National Assembly in 1953, the Noes didn't even consult this institution. Diem simply decreed rural revolution. By redistributing land in areas where there had been large landowners, plantations, and abandoned land, he sought to empower the peasantry, expand the Republic of Vietnam's administrative control, promote economic prosperity, and, in so doing, legitimate his nation-building. Diem could look to successful non-communist models in Japan, Taiwan, and South Korea, where land reform had sparked an increase in agricultural production and created the foundation for export-led growth capable of financing industrialization. Land reform was an administrative weapon, too. The First Indochina War had convinced the Noh brothers that the communists had successfully used land reform to extend state control over their people and territory. The Noes were now confident that they could fight the communists and expand their own socio-political base using the enemy's own methods. The Americans largely agreed and backed them at the outset. In February 1955, the government lowered rent payments, which farmers had to pay landlords, to between 15% and 25% of the value of the main crop's yield and authorized them to cultivate abandoned land. In 1956, redistribution began in earnest with the expropriation of land from large landowners. Unlike the Red River Valley, the Mekong Basin was home to many large landowning families. In fact, around 2,500 landowners possessed around 40% of the rice-producing land. In all, 2 million hectares of tenured land was theoretically available for redistribution. And yet land reform failed. In all, the government only distributed one-third of tenured land, while almost 50% of the RV's land remained concentrated in the hands of 2% of the population. Redistribution also occurred unevenly. In many areas, no land ever changed hands. What happened? For one, landowners resisted the government by paying off corrupt officials or threatening to withdraw their political support if Diem did not back down. "We have been robbed by the Viet Minh over the years," one landowner bemoaned, "and we resent similar treatment from the national government." That this individual was the chief of his province revealed another problem. Diem's civil service was not up to such a Herculean task. It was badly understaffed, increasingly corrupt, and often administered by people who had no interest in seeing land reform succeed. In all, 400 officials presided over the Republic of Vietnam's attempted land reform, whereas the Democratic Republic of Vietnam had dispatched tens of thousands of cadres, and the Japanese had relied on 400,000 people to push through rural reform. Diem could have deployed the army to force landowner compliance, but he was loath to unleash class war and reluctant to risk a coup. In the end, the Nos backtracked, whereas the communists only feigned doing so via the rectification campaign. In so doing, the Nos left millions of peasants frustrated, tens of thousands of whom had already enjoyed land reform under the DRV before 1954. These farmers only reluctantly accepted the return of the landlords in late 1954 and would be quite ready to change loyalties if the local power relations were to allow for it. Land reform failure did not stop Diem in his state-building efforts. In mid-1956, he initiated a massive resettlement program known as Planning for Land. The main goal was to promote state consolidation by moving Vietnamese people into ethnically non-Viet highland zones. Diem wanted to establish the RV sovereignty in these peripheral yet strategically important areas where the French had separately administered the ethnic minorities until 1954. The Central Highlands were also areas in which the DRV had extended its own control during the First Indochina War. Just as importantly, Diem also wanted to relieve population pressure in the Delta by promoting ethnic Viet migration to the highlands. Immigrants there received plots of land, tools, seeds, and food grants, which allowed them to create new settlements in upland areas. By 1959, 125,000 immigrants lived in 84 settlements. In 1962, 230,000 people lived in 173 settlements. The problem was that the resumption of civil war in the South led Diem to go too fast and to use coercion instead of persuasion to move people, build new villages, and construct new roads. Moreover, this policy of internal colonization only exacerbated long-standing tensions between Viet settlers and the still majority non-Viet indigenous peoples in the highlands. Diem's quest for control over people and their loyalties also led him to decree an anti-communist denunciation campaign in early 1955. The president used this program to root out communist stay-behinds and sleeper cells in the countryside and to re-educate the large number of sympathizers, former bureaucrats, and members of the DRV's nationalist fronts and former administrators during the Indochina War. Republic of Vietnam security personnel and provincial officials received orders to classify the population in terms of family background, political affiliations, attitudes toward communism, the Democratic Republic of Vietnam, and the Republic of Vietnam. For those who posed little threat, the government organized village ceremonies and community self-criticism sessions. Re-education centers dealt with tougher cases. In carefully choreographed rituals, former communist supporters would ask for forgiveness from fellow villagers and local authorities before swearing allegiance to the Republican flag and its great leader, Ngo Dinh Diem. The Ngo brothers then went further. In January 1956, a presidential ordinance authorized the arrest and incarceration of anyone deemed a threat to national security. Concentration camps popped up as the security services and army arrested thousands of suspects, many of them, in fact, non-communists. Indeed, large numbers of democratic-minded, law-abiding political opponents of the regime found themselves censored or detained. More were rounded up following the promulgation in May 1959 of an even more draconian piece of anti-communist legislation, Law 1059. It created special military tribunals with the power to arrest, imprison, and execute people for vaguely defined revolutionary activities. Between 1954 and 1960, this anti-communist offensive incarcerated almost 50,000 people. While non-communist journalists, politicians, judges, and artists ended up in jail as well, No Dinh Diem's dragnet did in fact inflict real damage on the Communist Party's underground organization. The Vietnamese Workers' Party's clandestine membership below the 17th parallel fell from 50,000 in 1954 to 15,000 in 1956. By 1959, the party counted only 5,000 remaining members in southern Vietnam. It was in this desperate situation that party cadres began to plead with the leadership in Hanoi to change the VWP's line so that they could pick up arms to defend themselves, even if it meant resuming civil war and risking American intervention. But it was also in this context that the Ngo family started to go after anyone who defied its power and state-building project, including non-communist nationalists like Nguyen Thuong Tham and politically-minded religious movements such as the one coalescing rapidly around the Xai Loi Buddhist Pagoda in downtown Saigon. The Ngos also pursued dissidents in their own ranks. Despite their ideological differences, both Ho Chi Minh and Ngo Dinh Diem clearly struggled to impose authoritarian rule and create the legitimacy for these two different Vietnams that had emerged from a century of French colonial rule. Neither brooked any opposition to their right to rule. After all, Diem was not the first to try to crush religious movements and separatism in the South. Ho Chi Minh had first sent Nguyen Binh to try to do this in late 1945. And behind Diem and Ho, of course, stood Minh Mang with his hard-handed efforts to hold Vietnam together in the mid-19th century. This, too, was modern Vietnam. Chapter 11. Toward One Vietnam. Despite the massive levels of propaganda, not everyone in the Democratic Republic of Vietnam believed in the Communist Party's glorification of war. As in France and Britain after the First World War, the men who had fought were often among the first to speak of the ugly side of war and its terrible toll on soldiers and civilians. As an officer in the People's Army of Vietnam, Phu Thanh had witnessed some of the most violent clashes of the Indochina conflagration, and the thought of renewed violence depressed him. Influenced by Nikita Khrushchev's moves toward peaceful coexistence in 1956, and inspired by more realistic and critical accounts of massive Soviet suffering during the Second World War, Thanh and other veterans dared to express an anti-war message. In his 1963 novel, Breaking the Siege, Thanh's main character, a veteran of the First Indochina War, gives voice to an unmistakably pacifist message. Such is the war. It leads to so much suffering among the people. The war has and will lead to so much more suffering, hardship, disgrace, and hate. There is nothing praiseworthy about war, and a soldier's life is just miserable. If one can gain real fame in combat, then one has to pay a high price for it. One has to stop this bloodshed with its horror early. Tang's message was not what the communist leadership wanted to hear from one of its soldiers, not in 1963, as the Vietnamese Politburo prepared to go to war against the Republic of Vietnam and, if necessary, the United States. Such a realistic account of war went against the party's heroization of the conflict since the glorious victory at the Battle of Dien Bien Phu. Worse still, this came from a soldier still employed in the armed services. The man in charge of the planning for a new war and the former head of the Army's ideological propaganda department during the preceding one, General Nguyen Chi Tan, went after Fu Tang and others who promoted such a peaceful line. Starting in 1963, veterans who spoke of the horrors of war lost their positions in the Army, saw their works banned, and sometimes ended up behind bars. It was a humiliating and often devastating fate for men who had risked their lives for their country, but culture had once again to serve war. From 1963, there could be no peaceful coexistence as in the Soviet Union, not even on the cultural front. Civil war resumes, reasserting DRV sovereignty. Although the absence of elections in 1956 disappointed many of the Vietnamese Workers' Party, the leadership also had its hands full with the land reform fallout, the administration of new territories, and the modernization of the economy. Moreover, for the time being, Communist Vietnam's main backers, the Soviet Union and China, continued to caution against war in favor of peaceful coexistence. Nikita Khrushchev discussed this with Dwight D. Eisenhower in two summit meetings in the late 1950s. In April 1955, Zhou Enlai had stolen the show at the Afro-Asian Conference in Bandung by reassuring his listeners that his country had no intention of exporting communism. A year later, a top-ranking Soviet leader explained in Hanoi why in a nuclear world it was important to give peace a chance instead of believing that war with the capitalists could be the only way to communist victory. The Vietnamese side agreed in theory, but Ho Chi Minh warned that because of the presence of the American imperialists in the South, his party could not rule out armed action. Such reservations must have seemed warranted when, in 1957, Moscow stunned the VWP by proposing the admission of both Vietnams to the United Nations. The Soviet action certainly vindicated those in the party who had doubted the possibility of achieving national unification through peaceful coexistence. One such critic was Lê Duẩn. Born into a modest family in central Vietnam, Lê Duẩn became involved in radical politics as a railway worker in the 1920s. He joined the communists in 1930 and, after serving 5 years in prison, directed the party in central Vietnam until the French sent him back to Paolo Condor in 1940. He did hard time in the island prison until the Japanese capitulation in August 1945. When freed, he returned to the mainland and ran the Southern Party branch. This powerful man remained in the South after 1954 to lead the party's clandestine organization there. He repeatedly informed his party of the desperate situation created by Ngo Dinh Diem's repressive measures and did his best to provide local guidance. In mid-1956, he penned a report on the path of the revolution in the South. In it, he advised imperiled Southern cadres against taking up arms right away, explaining that the party had no real administrative structure or armed forces on which to rely. Until it could approve such an important policy change, political struggle had to remain the mot d'ordre. However, as the July 1956 deadline for holding elections passed, Duan urged his followers to remain close to the peasant masses, ready, as during the August Revolution in 1945, to seize the favorable moment to take power by force. The problem was that, as it had been in northern Vietnam in 1944-5, the communists in the South were not always in control. More often than not, communist cadres watched from the sidelines as revolts broke out spontaneously in the highlands and in delta provinces like My Tho and Long An. Those who supported such revolts